Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Camila Kadalska. How do we balance safety with the desire to leave no trace? That's the question that's been consuming the rock climbing community in wilderness areas.
There's no point in preserving it in a pristine condition if we can't go enjoy it.
Some Wyoming voters have received mail about the upcoming election that contains wrong or misleading information, including
early voting dates, which is underway, but they also frequently refer to candidates who are challengers as incumbents.
And we check in on the southeast section of the state for the latest edition of our primary election series.
You know, I filed at 4:30 on the very last day without even being sure at 4 o'clock that I was going to do it.
Those stories and more on Open Spaces. Stay with us.
I'm Anna Sale, host of the podcast Death, Sex, and Money, and a devoted listener to Wyoming Public Radio. When I'm in Wyoming and listening to Wyoming Public Radio, it's like another way to realize how incredible the relationship you can have between a radio and a listener is, because Wyoming is so sparsely populated. Like, you are speaking to so many people who are spread out across this broad landscape, and you're having this interaction. I kind of think of it as similar to podcasting. Like, you're putting your voice out there, and you're not really knowing what's going on in someone's life, but they could be like totally isolated on their own little patch of land in this big state and feeling connected. I love like hearing people mention listening to Wyoming Public Radio when they're doing things, when they're just like out. It's them and the elements and Wyoming Public Radio, you know? So it's again a reminder of just how sacred that relationship between, you know, audio and a listener can be.
Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadalska. Close to 200 former incarcerees and their families returned to a relocation camp in northwest Wyoming for the first time since World War II as part of an annual pilgrimage. During the war, around 14,000 Japanese Americans from across the country were forcibly relocated to the Heart Mountain Japanese American Confinement Site near Cody after the attack on Pearl Harbor. Today, it's one of the best-preserved relocation sites among the 10 camps that are mostly found in the West. Wyoming Public Radio's Olivia Wheats joined a survivor as he and his wife revisited an area where some of the original structures were within view.
Okay, shall we go for a walk?
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, let's head over somewhere where we can see the see the railroad, and we'll talk about what you remember seeing when you first got here.
Shuko Yoshikami, who's now 86, was just 4 years old when he, his parents, and three siblings were sent by train from Southern California to Heart Mountain. They spent about 3 years there. Shuko, his wife, and I visited a restored barracks and some other sites near the camp.
We arrived by train. What I do remember distinctly was looking out the window and seeing irrigation canals, water flowing. We're going one direction, so in the opposite direction, the water is flowing down. And I don't remember too much after that, but I do remember being in our barracks and being very cold because we came from Southern California, and so we had extra clothing on. Eventually, I think my parents had, my mother had a pea coat, a navy pea coat, I remember. And my father had the army gray coat. Rest of us, we wore multiple clothing, and since we came from Pomona, we were just for summer. Hartman was good for kids like me, but not good for people who were just graduating college or high school and beginning the careers of life, and especially people who knew more of the law of the land. And I'm thinking of an exhibition I saw at the Smithsonian American History Museum. This was probably in the late 80s, and it was a teacher from Florin, California, and she said when she was incarcerated, and it was probably one of the internment center like Tan Phrang, she saw her friends on the other side of the fence, and then she says, "And when the gates closed behind me, I knew I lost something. And I realized it was my constitutional rights as a U.S. citizen." And that hit me. You know, you don't think of those things as a kid. You're just living.
Sure. Thanks for sharing that. Let's walk over to where this barrack is, and we'll talk a little bit about life in the barracks and what you remember about living there.
Sure. This sort of looks like it, because this is tar paper and had these battens nailed down. And the door, well, this is a bigger door, but looks like our door because it had this, but it's, you know, regular house door size here. I remember seeing searchlights. They used to have searchlights, but that didn't last too long. But then that was by 40, but it had to be 44 because my brother was born in, and we were in block barrack 3, barrack number 3 and 17. But we would lie out and look out, and you could see this. It's daylight still, you know, at 9 o'clock, and we're lying in bed, and we're supposed to be sleeping. You can't sleep, so we told stories.
Did you play any, like, ball games or the other kinds of just outdoor games that you played?
What kind of games have we played? We played...
Alley over.
Oh, yeah, alley over, you know, throwing a tennis ball, very precious, a ball. And we'd throw the ball over the barrack, and the team on the other side, if you catch it, and that's honor system, you catch it, then you alley over, ball's not coming over, and you come running around the other side and you throw the ball or touch somebody with the ball, and now they're poisoned, so they're on your side. And then so you gather, and the side that ends up with everybody is the winning side. Anyway, so everybody wins, I guess, in that game. That was lots of fun, and lots of running around and yelling and screaming.
Yeah, Shuko, show me where the school was here on this map.
Yeah, the school. Let me orient this map. Let's see. This here. This is where we are. This Heart Mountain over there. I think school was in block 25. I'm sure it was there because here's this baseball park here. Park. Yeah, it's a park. Playground, I guess. So we'd walk up this way and walk by the park and then go to school. My classroom was further. Sometimes I would walk. But my kindergarten teachers were Miss Kamei, and her brother was a classmate of mine, and she was a kindergarten teacher. And that was when I came back from the hospital from pneumonia, because they had a Boy Scout parade in block 17. I was watching it, and then my heart, my chest was sore, so I went home, and my mother says, "Oh, what are you doing home?" I said, "Oh, my chest hurts." Then the kids told her, she asked the kids, "What's wrong?" And the kids, they make up stories. "Oh, he got hit in the chest by baseball. Oh, that's terrible." Talked to the doctor later on. He said, no, if he hit by chest, he'd be dead. He won't be moaning about the pain now. And so then Army car came and picked me up. I guess that's the ambulance. This is a four-door sedan put in the hospital there. And my mother comes, and a couple of days later, nothing's happening to me. So she realized that she better get a real doctor in there.
They weren't helping you caring for you there?
I don't know. I don't know what they were doing. According to my mother, they weren't doing anything. So she went to her family doctor from Los Angeles, and she gave him $100. I don't know where she got the money from. And according to her, she said, "Oh, before you know it, they're taking x-rays, it might be." And I was diagnosed, I had pneumonia. And so I was in hospital there, and she visited me every day. I was there for about 10 days.
How do you think that your experiences here at Heart Mountain, at school, the friendships you made, also, you know, some of the times that may have been more challenging, shape who you became as an adult? Anything you feel like you learned from the experience?
Why do I remember so much? Because it was so different from the ordinary, and we're always moving, and you note the season, the time, and that's why I think I remember all these things, because things were changing. When everything's the same, you don't remember things. We remember change, and there are very drastic changes going from a place in Los Angeles, going to Pomona, and then coming to Heart Mountain. How am I feeling inside? Well, I just feel kind of happy. It may be strange, but what's nice is not the, I guess we could, all the cruelty and all the other things could be forgotten. But as we're riding up here from Salt Lake, my brother who was born here, and my sister came as an infant. She remembers very little, so much so that she told her friend, oh yeah, we used to go up to hiking up Heart Mountain all the time. And the friend said, oh, Heart Mountain's so far away. Well, she was talking about the foothills that we went. But I hear they're chatting to each other, and I'm interjecting things that I remember. I thought, oh gee, I wonder if my parents would really be happy to be overhearing our conversation of the thing, because it formed our family. And it brought us closer together. Well, we were always close together, but it was the family, I think, that was important. And I think that's what Heart Mountain did, probably strengthen the family. Like these traumatic incidents in life shaping us. It's like forging a sword, you know? You got to beat the sword, and you got to mix the metal and make it stronger. Otherwise, you'd be fragile and would break under any adversity.
That was Shuko Yoshikomi, a survivor of the Heart Mountain Japanese American confinement site, speaking with Wyoming Public Radio's Olivia Wheats. The Senate Conservative Leadership Caucus was a short-lived nonprofit organization founded by three Wyoming state senators. Its purpose? To pay at least one out-of-state resident to visit Cheyenne and give favorable public testimony on a bill those senators wanted to pass. The bill was a ban on gender-affirming care for minors, and the testifier was one of a handful of individuals who travel the country fighting for such bans in state after state. To this day, it's unknown how much money changed hands. I sat down with Wyoming Public Radio's Jeff Victor, who's been trying to get answers. Okay, Jeff, how did this group get on your radar?
Well, we have to go back to the winter of 2023. The Senate Committee for Labor, Health, and Social Services was working on a bill nicknamed Chloe's Law, which was meant to ban gender-affirming care for transgender youth. Basically, the bill said that if you were a doctor or another medical professional and you prescribed hormone blockers or hormone therapy, or you performed gender-affirming surgery for anyone under the age of 18, the state could take away your medical license.
Okay, and to be clear, these committee meetings are where lawmakers take a closer look at the bill in question and get feedback from members of the public, right?
Correct. It's the main opportunity the public has to offer their input during the session. And there was one testifier that day who really stood out. Her name was Luca Hine. Hine is a young woman from Nebraska who received a double mastectomy at the age of 16. And Hine says she and her parents were basically coerced into consenting to that surgery.
There was nothing wrong with my body. I was just a teenager that was uncomfortable. And instead, I was pushed down a path that taught me that growing up was a disease that needed to be cured with surgery and medicine.
Hine says she was made to believe that she was a trans boy and pushed into a surgery that she now regrets. It's important to note that it's extremely rare for someone at that age to undergo such a major surgery. Medical professionals have told Wyoming lawmakers in this and other meetings that these kinds of surgeries are not considered acceptable for transgender youth, and that they never happen in Wyoming. Hormone blockers and hormone therapy do take place before the age of 18, but when it comes to surgery, that is usually reserved for adulthood.
Okay, got it.
Hine's story is an outlier in other ways, too. For example, a 2021 meta-analysis of 27 other studies found that regret following surgical transition is exceptionally rare. We're talking less than 1%. People who can access gender-affirming care report a higher overall well-being and find it easier to form meaningful relationships with other people. They're less depressed and less likely to think about or attempt suicide. The rate of regret for these gender-affirming surgeries is much lower than for other major medical interventions. Some research has even found you are actually more likely to regret having a child than undergoing a surgical gender transition. We often hear claims that this regret is common. It's not very common, despite what Hine's testimony might suggest.
Okay, so let's step back a second. Why was a Nebraska resident testifying at a Wyoming legislative hearing?
Well, she was paid to be there. Shortly after Hine's testimony, lawmakers heard from another commenter, Marcy Shaver, the Wyoming State Director for American Atheists. She was there to oppose the bill, but Shaver also asked about Hine being there.
I would like to know who is financing the young woman who's touring the country giving testimony at various legislatures.
Hine has testified before several state legislatures, including in Missouri and in her home state of Nebraska. There's a small handful of detransitioners like Hine who tour the country testifying to state legislatures in favor of bills banning gender-affirming care for minors. That handful includes the woman from California for whom Chloe's Law was named. And they're often paid by advocacy groups to testify. And that line of work can be lucrative.
Did Hine or any lawmakers respond to Shaver's question about Hine being paid?
No, but that's not really how public comment works. However, at the end of the meeting, Senator Bouchard addressed Shaver's comment.
There was a question by someone on about the who financed the travel, and it's going to come out.
Bouchard said Shaver had attacked him a lot on social media.
And Senator Larson, Senator McEwen, and myself, we formed an outside entity called the Senate Leadership, Conservative Leadership Caucus. We raised money, and we help, and we want to continue to help make sure there's testimony to make sure this bill advances.
I had never heard of lawmakers doing this to pay for testimony, and I couldn't find anything about this happening before, in Wyoming or anywhere else, although that doesn't mean it hasn't happened elsewhere. But because it's a nonprofit, I wanted to check out its tax filings. So even though they don't pay taxes, nonprofits do typically have to file some documents in lieu of taxes. Those documents usually tell us how much money they've raised and spent, who's on their board of directors, and how much their executive director is paid. Smaller nonprofits can sometimes report even less, but they still report some of that. So I waited for those filings to be released.
And what did they show?
As it turns out, the senator's nonprofit is exempt from filing any kind of tax documents. So some nonprofits, like churches, are exempt from this public disclosure requirement. The IRS also exempts a, quote, caucus or association of state or local officials. So there is no filing for the Senate Conservative Leadership Caucus because it's not required to file that paperwork.
So what does that mean for your investigation?
It means that we will only get that information if Senator Bouchard and the others volunteer it. I've called and emailed all of them and gotten no response. I also reached out to Luca Hine, but she didn't respond either.
Okay, does paying someone to testify to the legislature break any Senate rules about conduct or transparency?
That was something I was curious about. So I called Senator Chris Rothfuss, the minority leader in the Senate who's been there for more than a decade. He told me,
there aren't any rules or requirements for what is allowable for bringing in outside experts or advocates or interest groups, either for or against legislation.
That's according to the official rules of the Wyoming Senate. Rothfuss added that politicians are always trying to come up with clever or creative ways of exploiting loopholes to make their bills successful. That's just politics. But forming a nonprofit to pay for testimony was a new one.
I haven't seen, to my knowledge, legislators forming an entity for the purpose of recruiting lobbyists or advocates or interested parties.
So Senator Rothfuss mentioned lobbyist, and that's making me wonder, isn't this just lobbying? Was this person who was paid to testify just acting as a lobbyist?
Hine did not register as a lobbyist. She does not appear in the publicly accessible list of Wyoming lobbyists for 2023 or for either of the surrounding years. In Wyoming, a lobbyist is defined as someone trying to influence legislation on behalf of some organization. And all lobbyists are required to register with the Secretary of State's office if they're getting paid. It doesn't matter how much they're paid or if those payments are simply expense reimbursements. Not registering as a lobbyist when you're working as a lobbyist would be a misdemeanor crime in Wyoming, punishable by a fine. I reached out to the Secretary of State's office to ask if Hine should have registered as a lobbyist, and I received no reply.
Okay, so we still don't know how much money was raised and spent for her testimony. Where does this all stand now?
Chloe's Law ultimately failed, but Bouchard brought a very similar bill back in 2024, and that one did pass the legislature and got signed into law. It went into effect last month. As for the Senate Conservative Leadership Caucus, the Secretary of State's Business Center site shows it was administratively dissolved in March.
All right. Well, Jeff, thank you for sharing what you found.
My pleasure.
Some Wyoming voters have been getting mail about the upcoming elections that contain inaccurate information. More on that on Open Spaces. Stay with us.
On Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, we cut through the distracting clutter in the week's news and get to what really matters.
It's sweet, but can we talk about the nipple rings?
I'm Peter Sagal. Join us as we take the shirt off the news and see what's under there every week on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Saturday morning at 10 and Sunday afternoon at 4 on Wyoming Public Radio.
Coming up on Wyoming Sounds, it's New Music Wednesday with me, Melanie Nielsen. Join me for new music from Cowboy Ross Cooper, The Fratellis in Babe Rainbow, Fruit Bats, Corb Lund, and this one from Galen McKinney from the McKinney Zone. Tune in 9 to noon for Wyoming Sounds on Wyoming Public Radio.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. We're in the heart of campaign season for the August 20th primary, and for some Wyomingites, mailboxes, emails, and voicemails are filling up with election-related literature. Maggie Mullen is a reporter at WyoFile who's been working with a team of her colleagues to look into some of these mailers, texts, phone calls, and door knocks to get a sense of who's trying to sway your vote. Mullen sat down with Wyoming Public Radio's Nikki Ouellette to share what she's learned about mailers some Wyoming voters have received recently.
Let's start with one that was sent out to voters in Albany County's Senate District 10. How did you first learn about these mailers? Did you get one?
So I actually didn't get one of these mailers, and I first heard about them from voters who had. The one we're talking about has this yellow font, a picture of a bear sort of darkened in the background, and it talked about gun rights. But then the photograph on it stood out to us because there's a candidate there by the name of Keith Kennedy. We knew what he looked like, and we knew that the photograph was not showing that man. And so that's kind of what started us off looking more into, okay, well, what's going on in this mailer? Who is the man in this photo? And of course, nowadays we have access to new types of technology that allow us to search Google for images. And that's when we found out the man that is pictured is actually of the same name. His name is Keith Kennedy. He lives in Virginia and he worked for the U.S. Senate for a number of years. And so he had a photo taken of that time. And that photo is the first thing you find when you Google the name Keith Kennedy. So that reporting process eventually brought me to tracking down that gentleman's contact info and giving him a call to also ask, are you aware that your photograph is being used in mailers? And he wasn't.
Tell me more about this group, Make Liberty Win, who sent out this particular mailer. What have you been able to find out about them? And what kind of issues or particular candidates are they promoting here in Wyoming?
They are a political action committee, and they formed a few years ago. This is a very well-funded political machine. Just since the beginning of 2023, they've been able to raise a little over $8.7 million. Most of that money has come from Texas. I look through their FEC filings.
That's the Federal Election Commission?
Yes, and I didn't find any donations from Wyoming, so it's fair to call them that they're completely out-of-state political action committee. Through my reporting, I've not ever been able to get in touch with them, but for whatever reason, the PAC has decided to involve itself in legislative races in Wyoming, which aligns also with goals on their website. I think it's, quote, electing 250 liberty-defending state legislators across the country. And so it's not just Wyoming. There's been some reporting in Idaho about some significant amount of money that they've spent there. But they have been very active. They have had several different mailers go out. And most of those mailers, not all, but the majority of those mailers have been in support of candidates who are either members of or ideologically aligned with the Wyoming Freedom Caucus. And that's a group of hardline Republicans in the House that have been organizing, formed a few years ago, and they're looking to take majority in the House this election.
Thinking about some of the other materials that Make Liberty Win is sharing in Wyoming, have you noticed other inaccuracies?
Yes, some of those inaccuracies have been about early voting dates, which is underway. But they also, and they did this in this particular mailer in Albany County, they frequently referred to candidates who are challengers as incumbents. If a voter comes across one of these mailers, they might be under the impression that a challenger running for their district is actually someone who's already gotten this job once before and they've done it before.
What have you heard from voters about receiving this kind of literature?
A lot of the feedback that Wyofile has gotten has been a lot of disappointment and a lot of shock. This type of campaigning is new to Wyoming. At least that's what I've heard from voters. I think this sort of flavor of campaigning of big out-of-state money providing mailers to voters that is not just inaccurate, but really just sort of outlandish in its inaccuracies. And we won't really know until this first campaign finance deadline just how much money is being spent right now. But I think voters are also getting this impression that there is a lot of money being spent.
Separately, the Wyoming Freedom PAC has recently been sued by two lawmakers, and these two lawmakers from Sweetwater County are claiming that mailers were sent out by the PAC criticizing them for votes that they say never happened. What is the backstory on that one?
Yeah, so this political action committee, it's sort of the fundraising arm for the Wyoming Freedom Caucus. It formed in 2023, and these mailers that have gone out, this is some of the first sort of large expenditures that we've seen come out of the PAC. And these mailers make several allegations against several lawmakers across the state. But the claim at the center of this defamation lawsuit is that the Wyoming Freedom PAC accuses several sitting lawmakers. They say this two different ways, that they either, quote, voted with the radical left to remove President Trump from the ballot, or they write, quote, this lawmaker voted no to keep President Trump on the ballot this fall. The Wyoming legislature has never in its history considered, debated, voted on any proposal to remove former President Donald Trump from the ballot. So these two lawmakers out of Sweetwater County are two freshman lawmakers, Representative J.T. Larson and Representative Cody Wiley. They've filed this suit. So we'll see what happens with that. But, you know, as far as why the Wyoming Freedom PAC would make these allegations, essentially, there was a footnote that while the House was debating the budget bill around whether or not the Secretary of State could enter or initiate out-of-state litigation without the approval of the legislature. The Secretary of State had been involved with litigation concerning, if listeners will remember, in Colorado, the Supreme Court there said Trump can't be on the ballot. Ultimately, the U.S. Supreme Court overruled them, but Secretary of State Chuck Gray was involved with an amicus brief in that case. And so lawmakers debated this back and forth. There was a vote as far as, do we want to keep this footnote or do we want to remove it? And it's that vote that folks at the Wyoming Freedom PAC say that was effectively a vote to remove Trump from the ballot.
I'm curious if you have a sense of the type of impact that this kind of electioneering political speech, does it get people out to vote?
The candidates who have been attacked by these mailers have told me, like when they've gone out door to door to talk to voters, that they've encountered some of the language in the mailers being spoken back to them from voters, you know, asking them, did you support this? Did you do this? I heard you did this. So candidates are coming up against that voters are getting these mailers and taking them at face value, at least to some degree.
So let's end on some news you can use. What advice do you have for voters as we wade into these final weeks of primary campaigning? Like, how are you spotting misinformation in mailers, in texts, emails?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure voters are feeling like they're getting a fire hose of information, but I think that's why it's that much more important to, you know, any kind of political mailer that you get, your baseline should be skepticism. but also to, you know, do a little bit of digging yourself. And if you feel like I can't do that digging myself, to call up your local news, your local Wyoming Public Radio or WyoFile, and we'll see what we can do to help you out.
Well, Maggie Mullen, reporter at WyoFile, thank you so much for sharing your reporting about these mailers that are going out and misinformation in the upcoming election.
Thanks, Nikki. Appreciate it.
Coming up, we circle down to the last quadrant of the state, what you need to know about the primary elections in the Southeast. This is Open Spaces.
Wyoming Public Media now brings you our daily news roundup, delivered right to your inbox. You'll read interesting stories from just down the street and around the state. Subscribe to our daily roundup at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Hi, it's Daryl Brogdon here with the Underground Martini Bunker, home of the Retro Cocktail Hour. I hope you'll join us every week for classic tiki tunes, TV crime, jazz, swinging soundtracks, and more. You're the designated driver on the Highway of Cool at the Retro Cocktail Hour. Saturday night at 6 on Wyoming Public Radio.
Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Camila Kodalska. And now to The Road to Cheyenne, our special series previewing the primary elections. This week, we're looking at state legislative races in the southeast corner of the state. Here with me today are Wyoming Public Radio's Laramie-based reporter Jeff Victor and our state government reporter David Dudley, who's based in Cheyenne. All right, Jeff, let's start with you. House races in Albany County are a little different from some of the other areas that we've talked about so far in this series. Basically, in Albany County, the general election is more contested than the primary. Why is that?
Well, for most of the state, the electorate is pretty conservative, and the main contest in a lot of areas is between Republicans, meaning the winner of the primary is likely to be the winner of the general, so the primary is really the race to watch. That's not the case in Albany County, where we have sometimes very close contests between Democrats and Republicans.
Is that because of the university? I think the stereotype is that the city of Laramie, where most of Albany County residents live, is full of Democrats.
Yes and no. It's true that Laramie, both on and off campus, is more socially liberal. But currently, about 63% of registered voters in Albany County are Republicans, while less than 24% are registered as Democrats.
So that sounds like Albany County should safely be Republican. How are Democrats getting elected there?
Quite a few of those registered Republicans are not ideological conservatives. Some of them are more liberal-leaning folks who register Republican to vote strategically. So, for example, voting for the more moderate Republican candidate during the primary because they'd prefer that to someone more far right, but then they vote Democrat in the general. So when you look at who gets elected, three of our four House seats are held by Democrats. One of our two Senate seats is as well. So the split is a little more even than the voter registration data would have you believe.
Okay, so we'll be checking back in on Albany County for the general for those Republican-Democrat showdowns. But are there any primary contests we should be paying attention to now?
On the House side, no. Albany County is neatly divided into four House districts, and in each of those, there is just one Republican and one Democrat running.
What's going on there? Why aren't there any primary contests for the House races?
On the Republican side, there seems to be more interest in county and municipal races. So, for example, there are four Republican candidates for the one county commission seat on the ballot this year. But on the other side of the aisle, Albany County Democrats Chair Mike Selmer told me it was a tough year when it came to recruiting candidates.
There were a lot of folks that would have been good candidates for city council or for legislature and for Senate, all the different seats mm-hmm. that were approached and said, yeah, I've always wanted to do this. I like the idea of running, but not this year. I bet we had a list of 60 names that we had contacted.
Selmer said the reason why many decided not to run was the prospect of political violence, and in general, the heated partisan rhetoric we're seeing at the national level. on the last day of candidate filing, the Democrats still didn't have a candidate for Senate District 10. So Selmer put down his own name.
You know, I filed at 4:30 on the very last day without even being sure at 4 o'clock that I was going
to
do it.
It really just goes to show how difficult it was for Democrats to recruit this year.
Okay, so talk to me about Senate races in this area.
Yeah, so Albany County has two Senate seats. Senate District 9, which mainly represents Laramie, is not on the ballot this year, but Senate District 10 is. It encompasses the rest of the county outside of Laramie and a few neighborhoods within city limits, including West Laramie. That's the seat Selmer is running for, and like he said, he's the only Democrat. But two Republicans are also running.
Who are they?
Keith Kennedy, a lobbyist for agricultural interests, and Gary Crum, a former UW football star and banker. It's worth noting that the incumbent, Dan Furphy, is not running again, but he has endorsed Crum. I interviewed Kennedy, and I've been trying to reach Crum, but we haven't talked yet. However, I did at least get to see him answer questions during a local candidate forum.
Okay, and where do they stand on the issues?
Both men are pretty conservative. For example, they both believe in school choice and in funding private schools with public dollars. And they've both signaled their support for a new law requiring schools to out transgender students to their parents. But when you get into other social issues, like abortion, it becomes clear that Kennedy is the more conservative.
Abortion should not be legal in Wyoming, nor should pharmaceuticals be used for abortion.
Meanwhile, here's Crum.
I'm pro-life. But there is a place for abortions when the mother's life is in jeopardy.
Crum says he's running in large part to strengthen rural health care, and that's earned him the endorsement of the Wyoming Hospital Association. Kennedy, on the other hand, says he decided to run because he feels the government infringed on individual liberties during the pandemic. Kennedy is skeptical of the scientific consensus on climate change, and he's a vocal supporter of fossil fuels, although he prefers the term hydrocarbon industry. Crum has not spoken publicly about climate change, but he has said he supports an all-of-the-above approach to energy, which means supporting fossil fuels, but also wind and solar.
So subtle differences in this race. Thanks for that insight, Jeff. Now, David, since you live in Cheyenne, you've been keeping an eye on the races in Laramie County. There are a lot of seats that are being contested, so we're going to focus on a couple where the incumbents in leadership positions are being challenged. I'm talking about House Representative 43. Dan Zwanitzer has been in this seat for almost 20 years.
Yeah, and he's representing a more rural area, populated mostly by retirees, just south and east of Cheyenne. Zwanitzer narrowly edged out his Republican opponents in primary since 2018. Zwanitzer has served on numerous committees, including the House Judiciary Committee, Joint Revenue and Mental Health and Vulnerable Adult Task Force, to name just a few. When we spoke a couple of weeks ago, he said that he intended to retire from office, but he didn't see a suitable replacement to carry on the torch. So he told me that he's running again to, quote, right the ship. He said that he's seen more chaos in the past 2 years than at any time in the past 20, and it's all to do with the Freedom Caucus and their approach to politics.
There's all sorts of evidence that they're, you know, encouraged to vote a certain way. Not that we're not all encouraged to vote, but when you get a mass email or a mass text saying, here's how we're voting today on bills, it's really frustrating because you can't build on ideas.
And who's running against him?
Ann Lucas, a retired executive vice president for a local credit union, as well as a GOP central committee member. According to Cowboy State Daily, she was the first candidate to announce her candidacy. She aligns with the Freedom Caucus and has accused Zwanitzer of being a liberal. Lucas wants to see a more limited government and less taxation. After meeting Ms. Lucas at the GOP convention in March, I reached out to her several times to talk about her platform, decision to run for office. As of this morning, I have not received a response.
Okay, and the last race that we're going to take a look at is House District 4.
Yeah, this seat represents Wheatland all the way up to Glendoe and down to Chugwater. Jeremy Haroldson is the current representative. This district is a little different from the last ones we talked about in the sense that the incumbent is a part of the Freedom Caucus. Haroldson is the vice chair, actually. He was first elected to the seat in 2021 and is running for re-election to continue the work that he started then. He wants to see less regulation in Wyoming. During the past budget session, he sponsored a bill to repeal gun-free zones, which would include schools. During that budget session, Haroldson kind of got into a back and forth with Governor Gordon over funding for Wheatland's failing water tank. Basically, Gordon vetoed funds Haroldson had secured for it through ARPA. Haroldson thinks that it was vetoed because he ended up voting against the overall budget.
I mean, in layman terms, he pulled it out because I didn't vote for his budget. And so it definitely was a situation where he's playing politics with people's lives, and I ardently disagree with that.
Haroldson did recently get the funds through SLIB, the State Loan and Investment Board. The water tower is scheduled to be repaired ASAP.
Okay, and he has a challenger, Jeffrey Thomas. Is he more moderate?
According to Thomas, he is more moderate. He's the chief of the Guernsey Volunteer Fire Department. When we spoke, he told me that he intended to secure more funding for emergency services in Platte County. He's also concerned about the fentanyl crisis, as well as immigration along the southern border. Thomas told me that were he in Haroldson's shoes, he would have handled the water tank funding very differently.
Sometimes you just need to take the win, live to fight another day. Even if everything isn't perfect about the budget, at least you got what your constituents needed.
Okay, well, thank you, Jeff and David. This has been an insightful conversation. And just a reminder for our listeners that voter registration closes on August 5th. You can still register up until and on Election Day. You just have to go to your local county clerk to do it in person. And tune in to the last Road to Cheyenne before the primaries on August 16th. We will update you with the latest news to make sure you're prepared to vote on August 20th. And also check out our new elections guide at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Climbing is a growing sport out in the West, but the community is struggling with the ethics of doing it in wilderness areas. This is Open Spaces.
Neuroscientist Wendy Suzuki basically lived at her lab.
I just felt really, really bad.
So she started working out, which improved more than just her muscles.
My focus was working better, and that made me say, what's going on here?
Wendy's discovery has kept her active ever since. New ideas to help you keep your resolutions. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Sunday morning at 10 on Wyoming Public Radio.
Hearing one story over and over again gets pretty old pretty fast. On Morning Edition, you'll hear all kinds of stories, from the big news to things that are just fun. Listen to Morning Edition every weekday from NPR News.
From 5 until 9 on Wyoming Public Radio.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. Rock climbers have a long history of fighting the system, and now there's a massive uproar over proposed climbing regulations in the wilderness. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Merzbach reports on the ongoing debate over fixed anchors.
It's a blue sky summer afternoon high up in Grand Teton National Park. Shannon and Garrick Hart stand on a narrow ledge about 800 feet up a jagged rock face. Garrick, a mountain guide, is pointing to a cluster of metal rings, bolts drilled into the granite and chains hanging off of them.
They kind of blend into the rock. You can't really see them till you're within like 10 feet of them.
They're at the top of Guide's Wall. It's a popular first climb in the park, but you can't safely hike down. So Garrick threads a rope through those silver bolts.
And then I'm going to toss this rope down so that we can rappel down it.
Rope!
Next, his wife Shannon uses a little device to attach herself to the rope. It adds friction so she can slide down the distance of 15 stories to the next rappel station.
My carabiner's locked, my harness is double backed, and I just sit back on the rope, let my feet out wide, and walk down.
Today, there's not a cloud in sight, but earlier in their climbing career, the couple remembers a thunderstorm coming out of nowhere and using bolts like these to bail off a route halfway up.
We were in a waist-deep river of hail in the crack system that we were climbing, and we were rappelling as fast as we could to head for shelter.
Fixed anchors have been installed in wilderness areas for decades so climbers can get down safely. But now, they're a major source of controversy. They technically violate the Leave No Trace ethic of the Wilderness Act, which is enforced for other activities like mountain bikes. Last fall, the National Parks and Forest Service proposed implementing it for climbing anchors. Cynthia Hernandez is with the Park Service. She says when the new guidance was proposed, over 12,000 people wrote in, the majority against it.
We heard from the climbing community. We heard from park superintendents.
The federal agencies say climbing should still be allowed in the wilderness, but drilling holes into rock does damage natural resources. So they proposed removing anchors. But Hernandez says land managers could keep ones critical for safety.
We are just looking to create a system that provides a consistent and predictable approach from park to park.
Some wilderness advocates support the stricter enforcement, including Franz Commensend.
We're not growing wilderness, it's shrinking.
Commensend sits in his living room in Jackson Hole at the foothills of the Tetons. A towering wall of windows gives a view of a wide creek that bends around the house. Aspen trees and ponderosa pines cover the surrounding green hills. He thinks some things man should just leave untouched.
Do we put bridges over, you know, rivers in the wilderness that we would otherwise not be able to cross, perhaps? Do we put handrails on traverses on climbing routes because it might not be safe?
Climbers say even if some anchors are removed, people will still scale rock walls and just leave their own gear behind or try and climb down without it. Commensend says he doesn't want people to get hurt.
But if you think you're in a position where you might get injured, maybe you shouldn't be there. Maybe you should just say this face, this climb, this mountain shouldn't be climbed.
There's no point in preserving it in a pristine condition if we can't go enjoy it.
Andrew Lamb is at the International Climbing Festival a few hours away from the Tetons, having a quiet picnic under some cottonwood trees. He says the proposed regulations aren't that bad, but he's worried land managers could be anti-climbing.
I can see the trail and I can see the horse footprints that we already allow in wilderness areas. It would be hard for me to be like really hardline about one type of impact over another.
Neither the Forest Service or the national parks could offer any kind of timeline for a final plan managing those shiny metal bolts used by climbers. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Hannah Mersbach in Jackson.
The warming climate is behind some serious changes in a number of Colorado's high-altitude mountain watersheds. KUNC's Ray Solomon reports for the Mountain West News Bureau that streams and rivers are becoming more acidic and polluted with heavy metals like copper, iron, and zinc.
It's a bright summer day in the mountains. Research geologist Andrew Manning and some colleagues are hauling sensors, buckets, and other scientific equipment through thick scrub willow at the edge of a rushing mountain stream.
We are on the Upper Snake River, high in the Colorado Rockies, here at about 11,000 feet.
The Upper Snake doesn't look like a clear mountain stream. Instead, it has a distinct reddish hue. That's because the water is depositing iron onto the riverbed.
This is kind of a unique stream in that it has unusually high metal concentrations and high acidity.
Manning, who works for the U.S. Geological Survey, is here to keep tabs on those unusually high metals and acidity, a phenomenon known as acid rock drainage. His research points to sharp increases.
We look specifically at zinc and copper. It amounts to about a doubling of concentrations over the past three decades. And that's substantial.
Manning says it's all happening because of changes in the climate. Ground that is normally frozen year-round is now thawing, and the water table dropping.
You have large zones of the subsurface that never saw any water or oxygen because they're armored off by a frozen ground layer or under the water table.
But when the ground thaws or the water table drops, new rock high in sulfates is exposed to the elements. That makes the water acidic and allows heavy metals to leach out and flow into the waterways. That can kill plants, insects, and fish.
Of the water quality problems I deal with, this is the largest scale and the most daunting.
Ashley Rust is a water quality specialist with Colorado Parks and Wildlife. She says acid rock drainage is devastating to river ecosystems.
It can dissolve tissue, it can dissolve shells, like the exoskeleton or the outside of an insect's body. is made of like calcium carbonate material, and so the low pH will dissolve it, and so the insects can't live.
Fish populations are particularly at risk. The dissolved metals overwhelm their gills.
So it really messes with their own ability to balance internal chemistry.
As the effects intensify, Rust worries about a future with more silent waters stripped of life. And it's not just in Colorado. Researchers in Alaska have been seeing similar issues in waterways near thawing permafrost, the Arctic so-called rusting rivers. Research chemist Amanda Barker is with the Army Corps of Engineers Cold Regions Research and Engineering Lab.
Literally, the water looks orange. You're seeing, you know, impaired waterways that are just bright orange, and that's oxidized iron.
She says they don't know yet how widespread this problem is, but
anywhere you have permafrost that is thawing, you're likely going to see the waterways being impacted because you're exposing fresh mineral surfaces to weathering reactions.
On the Upper Snake, Andrew Manning and his colleague Sarah Warrix crouch at the river's edge, dropping a probe that measures acidity into the swirling water.
So our pH is 3.88.
They also collect water samples in plastic bottles. They'll take those back to the lab to analyze the metal content. Manning says beyond ecosystem damage, if levels continue to rise, that could mean problems for drinking water.
A lot of our mountain communities get their water resources from these streams. And if you begin to increase the metals enough high up, and you can't dilute it very well anymore, now they may have to start treating that water or taking it out in a different place.
He says municipal water managers would be wise to take note. In Summit County, Colorado, I'm Ray Solomon, KUNC.
Thank you for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show and all the stories you heard here can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. It can also be found wherever you get your podcasts, and we post all our stories on the station's social media platforms. Thanks to Ivy Engel, today's audio and digital producer. And thank you to Cody Hume, our social media.